Welcome back for another deep dive. This time we're going to be exploring those fascinating D-block elements.
Sounds exciting.
It is. You know from the chemistry lesson and PDF you sent me that this looks like it's going to be pretty challenging material.
Yeah.
And that maybe you have a big exam or presentation coming up on it.
Oh, definitely.
So I think we should really try to unpack some of the maybe not so obvious things that will really help you stand out.
Okay.
And we really need to get this right.
For sure.
Because D-block elements are so important in chemistry.
Oh, they really are. A lot of people think that D-block and transition metal are like the same thing, but
yeah,
it's actually a little bit more complicated than that.
Oh, really? So are you saying there are some imposters lurking among the transition metals?
You could say that. So all transition metals are D-block elements, but elements like zinc, cadmium, and mercury, even though they're technically in the D-block, they're not considered true transition metals.
Interesting. So what makes them different?
Their d orbitals are completely full in both their atomic and ionic forms.
Ah. So it all comes down to electron configuration.
It really does.
So is that why those elements are less reactive? I remember from the YouTube video that full orbitals often mean more stability.
That's a great point. You hit the nail on the head. Because their d orbitals are full, they tend to be less reactive than other transition metals. They've already achieved kind of a perfect electronic state.
Got it. So they might not be the most exciting elements on the block, but they definitely add something unique to the mix. Now, I remember the YouTube lesson kept saying how there are all these exceptions to the general trends in the D block.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot.
It made it pretty clear that this isn't a topic you can just memorize.
Yeah. You really have to understand, like, all the different factors at play. Like, take horizontal trends versus vertical trends in the D block.
Okay.
So, moving across a period, you're adding electrons to the same energy level, which means the changes are usually more predictable.
That makes sense.
But when you go down a group, you're adding whole new electron shells, which just complicates everything.
So horizontal relationships in the D block are kind of like those really close-knit friend groups, where vertical relationships are more like distant relatives who only see each other once in a blue moon.
Exactly. Okay, so let's shift gears a bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about metallic character.
This is where we get to think about what a typical metal looks like and acts like, right?
Exactly. So shiny, strong, and conductive, like the copper wire or aluminum foil we use all the time.
Yeah, I see that.
These properties come from the way their electrons are shared in metallic bonding.
Okay.
Which allows those electrons to move freely and carry heat and electricity.
So I'm curious about zinc, cadmium, and mercury.
Yeah.
The video mentioned that they're not as hard or resistant to heat as other transition metals.
Good catch. And you know what? Their full d orbitals actually play a role in this too. Yeah. So those full d orbitals kind of make it harder for them to form the really strong metallic bonds that you see in other d block elements.
Oh, that's interesting. So those full d orbitals are like a double-edged sword. They offer stability, but they can also make these elements a bit less metallic in their behavior.
Exactly. Now, how about we tackle atomic size?
Okay.
Remember how the video talked about a contraction? And it even showed a graph where the atomic size suddenly dipped in a weird spot.
Yes. I was wondering about that. What's going on there?
So that's called the lanthanide contraction, and it's actually quite fascinating. You see, atomic size usually gets smaller as you move across a period because the positive charge in the nucleus increases and pulls those electrons closer.
Right, right.
But as we move down a group, we'd expect size to increase because we're adding more electron shells.
Yeah, that makes sense.
BUT. In the 5D series, the elements are almost the same size as their 4D counterparts.
Whoa, really? Even though they're a whole row further down on the periodic table.
Exactly. It's like someone snuck in and shrunk them.
So what's causing this shrinking effect?
It's the lanthanide series. They come right before the 5D series, and their 4F electrons are really bad at shielding. So this means the outer electrons in the 5D elements feel a stronger pull from the nucleus, even though they're farther away. And this effectively shrinks them.
Oh, that makes sense. So those 4L electrons are kind of like flimsy umbrellas in a rainstorm.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
They just don't provide much protection from that nuclear charge.
Exactly. Now, speaking of holding on to electrons tightly, how do you think this affects ionization energy? So the energy required to actually remove an electron from an atom.
Hmm. Well, if an atom is holding onto its electrons tightly, it would take more energy to rip one away, right?
You're absolutely right. And in general, ionization energy increases as we move across a period,
Okay.
because the nuclear charge is getting stronger. But it usually decreases down a group.
Because the electrons are further from the nucleus.
Exactly. But you guessed it. The D block throws some curveballs our way.
Because of course it does. They like to keep things interesting.
Right. So the irregularities in ionization energy in the D block often come down to those special electron configurations we were talking about.
Like zinc, cadmium, and mercury with their full orbitals.
Yeah, those guys have the highest ionization energies in their periods.
Which makes sense. If they're so stable with those full orbitals, they're not going to give up an electron easily.
Exactly. And this really highlights how important electron configuration is. It dictates so much of how D block elements behave.
Okay, I'm starting to see a pattern here.
Good. So are you ready to tackle something that really sets D block elements apart?
Hit me with it.
Variable oxidation states.
Ah, yes, the shapeshifters, as the PDF called them. They can have multiple oxidation states, unlike most main group
It's
elements.
a really cool feature. And you know what gives them this flexibility?
Okay, lay on me.
They're D electrons. Both the D and S electrons can participate in bonding. So they have more options when it comes to gaining or losing electrons.
So it's like they have a wardrobe full of different electron arrangements.
Exactly. And they tend to show off their highest oxidation states when they bond with elements that are super electronegative.
Like oxygen and fluorine.
Right. Those elements are electron hogs.
So oxygen and fluorine are like the fashion police of the periodic table, making sure the D block elements are always dressed to impress with their highest oxidation states.
That's a great way to think about it.
So who's the ultimate fashion icon of the D block?
Oh, definitely manganese. It's
Uh-oh.
been found with oxidation states from +2 all the way up to +7.
Wow, what a show off.
Right. It really highlights the adaptability of these elements.
Okay, so let's move on to magnetic properties. I remember this had something to do with whether electrons are paired or unpaired.
Exactly. We're talking about paramagnetism and diamagnetism.
Okay.
So paramagnetic substances have unpaired electrons that act like tiny little magnets, and they're attracted to a magnetic field. But diamagnetic substances have all their electrons paired up, so they're not attracted to a magnetic field. They're actually slightly repelled by it.
So if most D block elements have unpaired d electrons, I'm guessing they tend to be paramagnetic.
You're good at this, but you know there have to be some exceptions, right?
Of course. I should have known better by now. Are those full d'orbital elements messing things up again?
You got it.
Hmm.
Zinc, cadmium, and mercury are diamagnetic because all their electrons are paired.
Figures. All right, now for my favorite part. Those gorgeous colors we often see with D block compounds.
Ah, yes. It's amazing to see chemistry come to life so visually, right?
Absolutely.
And it all comes back to those unpaired D electrons again. They can absorb visible light, which boosts them up to higher energy levels. And when they fall back down to their ground state, they release that energy as specific wavelengths of light. And that's what we see as color.
So it's like an atomic light show.
Exactly. But here's the thing. The color we see isn't just determined by the element itself.
Oh, what else is involved?
The oxidation state and the surrounding ligands also play a huge role.
So it's a team effort.
It really is. For example, titanium in the +3 oxidation state is purple, but when it's in the +4 oxidation state, it's colorless.
Wow, that's a dramatic change.
Right. So when we're looking at D block elements, we always have to remember that the whole chemical environment matters.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. Now, how about we tackle complex ions?
Okay, so remember, those are metal ions that are surrounded by other molecules or ions called ligands, right?
Right, ligands. And I think I remember that they're attracted to the positive charge of the metal ion.
Perfect. And you know what? D block elements are like masters at forming these complexes.
Why is that?
Well, for a few reasons. They're relatively small, they have high positive charges, and you guessed it, those d orbitals are ready and waiting to form bonds.
It's like they're the social butterflies of the periodic table, always surrounded by a crowd of ligands.
That's one way to think about it. And you know what? This talent for forming complexes is actually what makes them such great catalysts.
Oh, yeah. The PDF mentioned that, but it didn't go into too much detail.
So catalysts are really important for speeding up chemical reactions without actually being consumed themselves.
Right, they're like facilitators.
Exactly. And D block elements are really good at this.
But why are they so good at it?
Well, their variable oxidation states are a big part of it, because they can easily donate and accept electrons as needed to get the reaction going. And remember how good they are at forming complexes. That helps too, because they can actually bring those reactants together in just the right way for them to react.
So they're not just social butterflies, they're amazing matchmakers for chemical reactions.
That's a great analogy. And you know, this catalytic power has led to a bunch of important applications.
Like what?
Well, for example, vanadium V-oxide is a crucial catalyst in the contact process for making sulfuric acid, which is used in tons of industries.
Wow, that's huge.
Right. And the YouTube video talked about how finely divided iron is used as a catalyst in the Haber process for producing ammonia.
Which is essential for making fertilizers, right?
Exactly. And we can't forget about nickel, which is super important in catalytic hydrogenation, with applications in food production and even pharmaceuticals.
Wow, so D-block elements are like tiny, mighty catalysts that are secretly running the show behind the scenes in so many important processes.
They really are. Okay, so how about we talk about those interstitial compounds?
Those are the ones where those tiny non-metal atoms get squeezed into the spaces between the metal atoms, right?
Right, like how we talked about fitting those small items into the gaps in a suitcase.
Yeah, that's a good way to visualize it. So what happens to the metal when those small atoms get crammed in there?
Well, it changes the properties of the metal quite a bit.
How so?
The compound still conducts electricity like a typical metal, but it becomes harder and less malleable.
So they're like tougher versions of their original metal counterparts.
Exactly. And once again, those d orbitals are involved, providing sites for those interstitial atoms to bond.
It seems like those d orbitals are the real MVPs of the d block. They're involved in everything.
They really are incredibly versatile.
Yeah.
Okay, so last but not least, let's chat about alloys.
Okay. Those are just mixtures of metals, right?
Yeah, but they often have properties that are way better than either of the individual metals.
I see. So it's like combining the best of both worlds.
Exactly. Think about brass, for example. It's a mixture of copper and zinc, and it's known for being really durable and having a beautiful golden color.
And bronze is another classic alloy.
It is. It's made of copper and tin and has been used for centuries because it's so strong and resistant to corrosion.
What about stainless steel? That's everywhere these days.
Oh, that's a super important one. It's a combination of iron, chromium, and nickel.
And what makes it so special?
It doesn't rust, and it looks really sleek and modern.
Wow. So by mixing and matching different D-block elements, we can create materials with a whole range of enhanced properties.
Exactly. Yeah. It's one of the things that makes D-block elements so valuable. I'm amazed by how we use D-block elements for so many things, from everyday objects to like these really important industrial processes.
Yeah.
What did you think about how the lesson and the PDF like presented all this information?
You know, I thought it was really clever how they emphasized all the exceptions to those general trends.
Yeah.
It really made me think critically instead of just trying to memorize a bunch of facts.
Yeah. It definitely showed that to understand D-block elements, you got to dig a little deeper into their electron configuration and how that affects their behavior.
Yeah.
And I think the PDF especially did a good job of explaining those exceptions.
Yeah. Like, remember those weird dips in the melting point graph?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't just a nice smooth curve. There were these weird anomalies that made you go, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Exactly.
And a lot of those irregularities come from those unique electron configurations in D-block elements, like manganese.
Okay.
It has a really low melting point compared to its neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because its d orbitals are half full, which makes it more stable.
Oh, right. So it's kind of like how chromium moves an electron from its 4s orbital to its 3rd orbital.
Yeah.
So it can have that half-filled, more stable configuration.
Exactly. So even though they're not following the normal filling rules, they're actually prioritizing stability.
Right.
Which is pretty cool when you think about it.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
You know, I also appreciated how the PDF went into some more advanced concepts, like standard electrode potentials.
Oh, yeah. That was cool.
Which the YouTube video didn't even touch on.
Yeah.
And I think it explained it pretty clearly, like how these potentials tell us how easily a metal will oxidize. And I thought the example with copper was really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it has a positive standard electrode potential.
Right.
Which means it doesn't really want to lose electrons and become a positive ion.
Exactly.
And that's why, unlike iron or zinc, copper doesn't really react with most acids.
Exactly. It's almost like it's a more noble transition metal because it's not as reactive.
That makes sense. I also thought the PDF did a good job of breaking down those colored ions.
Oh, yeah. That's a fun topic.
And how the color we see isn't just about the element itself.
Right.
It's also about its oxidation state and what
Yeah.
ligands are hanging around.
It's a great example of how something that seems so simple, like color, can actually be super complex
Yeah.
at the atomic level.
Yeah.
Did you notice how the PDF mentioned that the absorption bands for D-block compounds are often super narrow?
Yes.
So they absorb like very specific wavelengths of light.
Yeah, and I think it connected that to why they're so useful as pigments and dyes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because those specific wavelengths are what give them their unique colors.
Right.
So cool how it all comes together.
I know. It really makes you appreciate how those tiny interactions at the atomic level are what create the world we see.
Yeah. The PDF also had a good explanation about how D-block elements work as catalysts.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
Like how they use their D orbitals to actually interact with these reactant molecules
mm-hmm.
and provide like a surface for the reaction to happen more easily.
So they're like little facilitators or something.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Yeah. And don't forget about their variable oxidation states.
Oh, right. That helps too.
Yeah. It means they can donate or accept electrons as needed, which makes them even better catalysts.
It's like they're the ultimate wingman for chemical reactions, just making sure everything goes smoothly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I love that analogy. Mm. So the YouTube video and the PDF both talked about those interstitial compounds.
Yeah.
But I thought the PDF did a better job of explaining how those little non-metal atoms that get stuck into the metal lattice actually affect the properties of the material.
Yeah, that was good.
It was kind of like, remember how we talked about those small items fitting to the gaps in your suitcase?
Right.
Well, this is like that, but on an atomic scale.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this stuffing actually makes the metal stronger.
Really?
Yeah. It becomes harder and less malleable.
Huh. So even those tiny changes at the atomic level can have a big impact on the material as a whole.
Exactly. And it just shows how crucial it is to understand electron configuration.
Yeah, it really seems like that's the key to understanding all the unique properties of these elements.
It is. And that's something we've seen over and over again in this deep dive.
Okay, before we move on, can we talk about something that always confuses me a little bit?
Uh-huh. What?
It's the difference between lanthanides and actinides.
Oh, yeah. Those F-block elements?
Yeah. They're always kind of tucked away at the bottom of the periodic table.
Yeah. They're kind of their own little world down there.
Like an afterthought.
Yeah. And they're both filling up their forbitals, but they have some pretty distinct personalities.
Mm.
So lanthanides tend to be less reactive, and they usually like to hang out in the +3 oxidation state.
So they're a bit more predictable than those wild D-block elements.
Exactly. Actinides, on the other hand, are way more reactive.
Uh-huh.
And they can have all sorts of oxidation states. Plus, they're all radioactive, which adds a whole other layer of complexity.
Oh, right. Radioactivity. That makes them inherently unstable, which I guess makes their behavior even harder to predict.
It does. But you know what? That instability is also what makes some of them super valuable.
Oh, yeah. Like in nuclear power and medical imaging.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So even properties that seem negative at first can be really useful.
That's true. And speaking of the lanthanides, remember that lanthanide contraction we were talking about?
Yeah.
How those 5D elements are smaller than we'd expect because of the poor shielding from the 4F electrons.
I do. Well, it turns out that that contraction doesn't just affect the D block.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It ripples out and influences elements further down the periodic table.
Wow.
Even into the P block.
So it's like a chain reaction of size and reactivity throughout the whole periodic table.
Exactly. It really highlights how interconnected everything is. You can't just look at one element in isolation. You have to think about how it fits into the whole system.
This has been a wild ride through D-block elements.
Mm.
So what would you say are the biggest takeaways from all of this?
I think the main thing is that D-block elements are incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
And they have this huge range of properties that all come back to their unique electron configurations.
Mm.
Their variable oxidation states, those colorful ions, their catalytic superpowers, and their ability to form alloys and those interstitial compounds. It all makes them super important for our world.
And it all boils down to those D electrons.
It does. It's amazing how these tiny little particles can have such a huge impact on the properties and applications of these elements.
It really shows how important it is to understand those basic principles of chemistry.
Absolutely. Like, if we can understand the electronic structure, we can unlock so many secrets about their reactivity, magnetism, and even their color.
Right. And all of those properties translate to real-world applications.
Yeah.
D-block elements are used in everything from construction materials to cutting-edge technologies and medicines.
I couldn't agree more. They really are the unsung heroes of the periodic table.
Yeah. I feel like I have a whole new appreciation for these elements. They're not just names and symbols anymore. They're like characters in this grand chemical story.
That's exactly how I feel.
So before we wrap things up, do you have any final thoughts to leave us with?
I do. Think about all the amazing properties and applications we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Where else could D-block elements be used in the future? What new frontiers could they help us conquer?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. It is kind of mind-blowing to think about all the possibilities, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll see them in like advanced materials for renewable energy technologies or even in those targeted drug delivery systems that everyone's talking about these days.
Yeah. Or maybe even better catalysts for green chemistry, like more sustainable ones.
Right. Because we definitely need those. Imagine if we could harness their catalytic power to create artificial photosynthesis, like actually mimicking nature to turn sunlight into energy.
That would be a total game changer.
I know. What about using their magnetic properties to create like new data storage devices, like way more efficient ones that could really boost computing power?
Exactly. And we could explore their ability to form complexes even more in bioinorganic chemistry.
Okay.
Like designing metal-based drugs that could target specific cells or disease pathways.
So we could treat diseases with way more precision.
Exactly.
It's really exciting to think about how much more we could learn about these elements and what other breakthroughs they could lead to.
That's the beauty of science, right? It's always evolving.
It is. And the more we learn about D-block elements, the more we'll uncover their true potential.
I agree. And this deep dive has really only scratched the surface. But hopefully it's made you curious to learn more.
It definitely has. I feel like I have a whole new appreciation for D-block elements.
Good. They're not just names and symbols anymore.
Right. They're actually like these dynamic forces that are shaping our world in so many ways.
And that's really what we were hoping to convey with this deep dive.
Yeah.
D-block elements are so much more than just a bunch of trends and properties to memorize.
Uh-huh.
They're the adaptable tools of the periodic table.
Right. Ready to meet whatever challenges we throw at them. I'm already excited to learn more. Who knows what other amazing discoveries are waiting out there?
That's the spirit.
Yeah. It's been awesome having you here to guide us through this exploration of the D-block elements.
It's been a pleasure.
We hope you, our listener, enjoyed this deep dive as much as we did. Remember to keep learning, keep asking questions, and never lose that sense of wonder. Until next time, happy exploring.